Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 29th reading of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Gunman on Police Radar by Elise Schmelzer, John Aguilar, and Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. Will Shortened Isolation Periods Spread the Virus? By Benjamin Mueller, the New York Times. Five killed, two wounded by shooter. Gunman on police radar. Suspect, 47, had ties to places he targeted. One attack mirrors description in a book. By Elise Schmelzer, John Aguilar, and Shelley Bradbury, the Denver Post. The 47-year-old man who shot and killed five people and wounded the two others during an hour-long killing spree between Denver and Lakewood was previously under investigation by law enforcement, police said at a news conference Tuesday. Police identified the shooter as Lynn McLeod and said he knew many of the people he targeted. McLeod opened fire in two tattoo shops, killed a clerk at a Lakewood hotel, and hunted two people inside their Denver homes. In a 2018 book connected to McLeod, the author described in detail a murder that closely mirrored one of Monday's attacks. McLeod had previously been investigated by law enforcement in 2020 and 21, but the investigations did not lead to state or federal charges, Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin said. The chief declined several times to describe the nature of the investigations. This individual was on the radar of law enforcement, Pazin said. Pazin said it was too soon to determine a motive for the killings Tuesday, which began in central Denver and ended in a busy Belmar shopping area in Lakewood. At least four of those shot worked at tattoo shops. Denver police did not release the names of the three people killed in Denver, but family members identified one of the victims as 44-year-old Alicia Cardenas. Jimmy Maldonado was wounded in Denver during the spree and is in critical condition at Denver Health, a hospital spokesperson confirmed. His wife, Elisa Gunn Maldonado, died in the shooting, according to a GoFundMe campaign set up by a friend. Lakewood police spokesman John Romero identified the two victims shot in Lakewood as Danny Schofield, 38, and Sarah Steck, 28. Steck died Tuesday in a hospital, Romero said. McLeod did not know Steck, but had a history with the hotel she worked at, the Hyatt House, Romero said. McLeod spoke briefly with Steck before shooting her, he said. Obviously, it could have been a lot worse than it was, Romero said. Belmar is a very popular area and was very populated at the time. An hour of violence. McLeod opened fire in at least eight different locations across the two cities before dying in an exchange of gunfire with a Lakewood police agent in the Belmar shopping district. Romero did not identify the agent who shot McLeod, but said she killed him after McLeod shot her in the abdomen. The agent underwent emergency surgery Monday night and is expected to survive. McLeod died at the scene. I can't say enough about the courage and bravery shown by the Lakewood police agent, Romero said. Police officials on Tuesday provided a timeline of the spree. At 5:25 p.m., Denver police received a report of a shooting at a business near East First Avenue and Broadway. Two women were killed, including Cardenas, and a man was injured. That man remained in critical condition but is expected to survive. Police then responded to a home at the 200 block of West 6th Avenue where the shooter broke into the building. The shooter fired at the occupants, but nobody was injured. Police believe the shooter was set then set a van on fire in the alley behind the building. At 5:45 p.m., Denver police responded to a residence in the 1200 block of William Street where they found a man shot and killed inside. The suspect was dressed in tactical gear and wore a police logo and badge when he gained entry into the building, according to an email to residents of One Cheeseman Place obtained by the Denver Post. A very similar attack was described in a 2018 book connected to McLeod. 4 minutes later, Denver police officers in an unmarked vehicle found a van that matched the suspect vehicle near Zuni Street and West 13th Avenue. Police pursued the vehicle until Zuni Street ended. The shooter then started firing at the officers, who returned fire. The shooter disabled the officer's vehicle and drove away. Lakewood police at 5:58 p.m. received a report of shots fired at Lucky 13 Tattoo Parlor on Kipling Street. Police found Schofield dead inside the shop. At 6:04 p.m., Lakewood police saw the suspect van near a Wells Fargo bank in the Belmar shopping area. Police tried to make contact and the shooter opened fire. Police returned fire, but the suspect escaped. At 6:10 p.m., the shooter entered the Hyatt house in the shopping area and shot Steck, who was working the front desk. At 6:12 p.m., a Lakewood police agent found the shooter on foot near the intersection of West Alaska Drive and South Vance Street. The agent ordered the shooter to drop his gun, but he shot her. The agent returned fire and killed him. Denver police first notified the public about the shootings with a tweet at 5:43 p.m. Monday, referencing the shooting at East 1st Avenue and Broadway. Police provided the next update at 6:27 p.m. when they tweeted about the shooting on William Street, 42 minutes after they received the call about the shooting and after McLeod was already shot. Lakewood police made their first notification about the shooting at 6:26 p.m. when they announced on Twitter there had been an officer-involved shooting in the Belmar area. Both Lakewood and Denver police encrypted their scanners, blocking the public from real-time information about reported crimes and police response. When asked Tuesday about the department's minimal public notifications, Pazin said the situation was rapidly evolving and that law enforcement across the metro area were notified to look for the suspect's vehicle. "There's law enforcement professionals from federal, state, and local that have come together to figure this out," he said. McLeod had several ties to the places he attacked Monday. He previously owned a business, Flat Black Ink Corp., in the 200 block of West 6th Avenue, the area of the second shooting, state business records show. The records show the business was formed in 2005 and was listed as delinquent in 2017. Flat Black Ink is also listed online as the publisher of three books written under the pen name Roman McClay that featured a character named Lyndon McLeod. In one passage in the first book, published in 2018, the author describes McLeod carrying out murder at an apartment complex on the south side of Cheeseman Park. The description mirrors the attack police saying McLeod carried out Monday at One Cheeseman Place in the 1200 block of William Street. Police responded to a report of shots fired around 5:45 p.m. and found a man killed inside the building. The shooter dressed in tactical gear and wore a police logo and badge when he gained entry into the building, according to an email from the building manager to residents of One Cheeseman Place. In the book, the author described staking out an apartment complex in the 1300 block of William Street, dressing in police gear, arming himself with a rifle, then going inside and killing people. The author names several specific victims, some of whom are real people who live in Denver. Once would be murdered there would be no legal reason to not murder everyone else. Any sentence he received would be the same for felony murder during a robbery when it was one of the 7 or 10 people, the author wrote in the book. The books were described in an online review as an epic, visceral journey into the dark heart of every man broken by society, according to one reviewer on the website Goodreads. Another reviewer on Amazon called the first book an 800-page alt-right rant and said it featured fantasies about killing people involved in the Black Lives Matter movement. It's important to note, as another one-star reviewer did, that this book represents characters who give full vent to their sexism, racism, and every other ism kept out of mainstream discourse. Another reviewer wrote, Colorado court records do not show any previous criminal history for McLeod. Will shortened isolation periods spread the virus? By Benjamin Mueller, the New York Times Company. The decision by federal health officials to shorten isolation periods for Americans infected with the coronavirus drew both tempered support and intense opposition from scientists Tuesday, particularly over the absence of a testing requirement and fears that the omission could hasten the spread of the highly contagious Omicron variant. The new guidance, coming amid a crush of new infections that has starved many hospitals of workers, seemed to some scientists like a necessary step to shore up workforces in essential industries. And encouraging people to leave isolation early after testing negative could spare them the hardships of prolonged periods of at home. But letting hundreds of thousands of infected people forego those tests, even if, crucially, their symptoms were not entirely gone, risks seeding new cases and heaping even more pressure on already overburdened health systems, experts said Tuesday. To me, this feels honestly more about economics than about the science, said Yonatan Grad, an associate professor of immunology and infectious diseases at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, who has tracked coronavirus infections in the NBA. I suspect what it will do is result in at least some people emerging from isolation more quickly, and so there'll be more opportunities for transmissions, and that, of course, will accelerate the spread of COVID-19, he added. Noting that people were unlikely to adhere strictly to masking advice after leaving isolation. Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said Tuesday that the new guidance had been necessitated by the volume of people about to be infected. In a series of holiday weekend meetings, she said, agency officials pored over transmissibility data for past variants and signs that Omicron caused less severe illness. But ultimately, Walensky said, she decided that the rapid tests were not effective enough at diagnosing infectiousness in people. We don't necessarily do a test if you don't know what you're going to do with the results, she said, adding, the anticipated number of cases that we're seeing required us to take action at this moment. The CDC's recommendations cut isolation periods for infected people from 10 days to 5. The agency did not recommend rapid testing before people left isolation. But some scientists maintain that rapid tests are the most convenient indication of whether or not someone remains contagious. Regulatory delays, manufacturing problems, and shortfalls in government support have left rapid tests in extremely short supply as the Omicron variant has surged, pushing caseloads to near record levels in the United States. Walensky denied that testing availability affected the agency's thinking and said that masking alone addressed the risk that infected people remain contagious after isolation. The CDC has asked infected people to wear a mask around others for 5 days after leaving isolation. We know that, let's call it 85% of your transmissibility time is already behind you, Walensky said of the 5-day isolation period. A minority of it is in front of you, and if you wear a mask, you can avert it. Scientists said that they worried that, like rapid tests, the most effective masks, known as N95s, remained out of reach for many Americans. The right isolation periods for Omicron depend on when people are testing, as well as individual level of immunity and the properties of the variant itself, scientists said. Some people remain contagious much longer than others, and evidence from rapid tests suggests certain patients are still infectious for longer than 5 days. I'd be very wary of translating data from Delta to Omicron, said Stephen Goldstein, a virus expert at the University of Utah. I think there's a potential for this to make things even worse or accelerate the course of the pandemic. Madden, voice of NFL, dies at 85. Hall of Fame coach reached millions from broadcast booth video game by Ben Spiegel, the New York Times company. John Madden, the Hall of Fame coach who became one of America's most recognizable ambassadors of professional football, reaching millions and generations from the broadcast booth and popular video game that bears his name, died on Tuesday. He was 85. The National Football League announced his death in a statement that didn't include the cause. In his irrepressible way and with distinctive voice, Madden left an imprint on the sport on par with titans like George Halas, Paul Brown, and his coaching idol, Vince Lombardi. Madden's influence steeped in every man sensibilities and studded with wild gesticulations and paroxysms and onomatopoeia, wham, doink, whoosh, made the NFL more interesting, more relevant, and more fun over 40 years. John Madden is as important as anybody in the history of football. Al Michaels, his broadcast partner from 2002 through 2008 with ABC and NBC, said in an interview in 2013, "Tell me somebody who did all those things that John did and did them over his over this long period of time." Madden retired from coaching the Oakland Raiders in 1979 at age 42 and with a Super Bowl victory to his credit, but he turned the second act of his life into an encore, a bawdy emissary sent but from the corner bar to demystify the mysteries of football for the common fan and in the process revolutionize sports broadcasting. Rising to prominence in an area of football, commenting that Hugh mostly toward a conservative, fairly straightforward approach, Madden's accessible parsing of X's and O's added nuance and depth and also a degree of sophistication that delighted an audience that in some cases tuned in just for him. Fastidious in his preparation, Madden introduced what is now standard exercise in the craft, observing practices, studying game film, and interviewing coaches and players on Fridays and Saturdays. Come Sundays, he would distill that information into bursts of animated, cogent, and often prescient analysis. Madden spent his first 15 years of broadcasting at CBS, starting in 1979. But the three other major networks all came to employ him because, at one point or another, they all needed him. Fox snagged him in the mid-1990s to establish credibility for its fledgling sports division. ABC followed in 2002 to boost the sagging fortunes of Monday Night Football. NBC hired him when it regained football in 2006 because, as Dick Ebersol, then the chairman of NBC Universal Sports, said, he's the best analyst in the history of sports. He's able to cut through from people my age who remembered him as a coach all the way to 12-year-olds. Madden received 16 Sports Emmy Awards, including 15 for Top Analyst. He parlayed his appeal into a series of career incarnations, commercial pitchman, successful author, video game entrepreneur, and embraced them all with zest. He produced 3 New York Times bestsellers. He peddled Boom, Tough Actin, Tenactin, as an athlete's foot remedy and broke through reams of paper and an odd door in advertisements for Miller Lite. His Electronic Arts video game evolved into a cultural phenomenon with annual midnight releases and widespread tournaments since its inception in 1988, selling tens of millions of copies with revenue in the billions. At his core, though, Madden was a coach and by extension a teacher, as he proudly noted in interviews. He graduated with a master's degree in physical education, a few credits short of a doctorate from California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo. His unscripted manner translated as well in the Raiders' locker room, where he guided a cast of self-styled outlaws and misfits to 8 playoff appearances in 10 seasons as head coach, as did in living rooms, man caves, and bookstores. As inclusive as he was beloved, Madden embodied a rare breed of sports personality. He could relate to the plumber in Pennsylvania, or the custodian in Kentucky, or the cameraman of his broadcast crew, because he viewed himself at bottom as an ordinary guy who just happened to know a lot about football. Grounded by an incapacitating fear of flying, he met many of his fans while crisscrossing the country, first in Amtrak trains and then in his Madden cruiser, a decked-out motor coach that was a rare, luxurious concession for a man whose idea of a big night out was detailed in his book, One Size Doesn't Fit All, 1988, was wearing a sweatshirt and sneakers to a real Mexican restaurant for nachos and chili Colorado. John Earl Madden was born in Austin, Minnesota on April 10, 1936, the eldest of 3 children, and the only son of Earl and Mary Flaherty Madden. His father was a mechanic. When John was 6, his family moved to Daly City, California, a working-class suburb of San Francisco whose proximity to the city offered adventurous escapes for sports-crazed boys. His family was of modest means, but Madden was resourceful. He scrounged for gear in rummage bins and fashioned his baseball bats by taping together pieces found at semi-pro games. Opportunities for minor league baseball beckoned. The Boston Red Sox and New York Yankees expressed interest, but Madden, from his time caddying for the well-heeled at the San Francisco Golf Club, had come to equate success with a college education. He bookended an unfulfilling year at the University of Oregon with stays at 2 community colleges. The College of San Mateo in California and Grays Harbor College in Aberdeen, Washington, before transferring to Cal Poly, where he would meet his future wife, Virginia Fields. There was prowess on the offensive line, attracted the Philadelphia Eagles, who selected him in the 21st round of the 1958 draft. Madden never played for the Eagles. A serious knee injury quashed his prospects. But while rehabilitating in Philadelphia, he began transitioning to the next phase of his life. Reviewing game film with Hall of Fame quarterback Norm Van Brocklin, Madden was encouraged to start thinking like a coach, and he pursued that calling back to California, where he worked for 4 years at Allen Hancock College, 2 as a head coach, and for 3 years at San Diego State as an assistant. Madden and his wife had 2 sons, Joseph and Michael, and a number of grandchildren. John and Virginia Madden's 62nd wedding anniversary was 2 days before his death. For all of his celebrity, Madden was perhaps most closely identified with his video game franchise, which connected him to younger generations. He was fond of saying that when many younger people met him, it became apparent to him that they knew him from the video game, not as a Hall of Fame coach or perhaps even as an innovative broadcaster. Not that he was complaining necessarily, he had fulfilled his father's wishes. Once you start work, you're going to have to work the rest of your life, Madden said, recounting Earl's advice in his 2016 induction speech at the Hall of Fame. Then he added, "I have never worked a day in my life. I went from player to coach to a broadcaster, and I'm the luckiest guy in the world." Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Seema Betts, June 30th, 1926 to December 25th, 2021. Seema was born June 30th, 1926 in Rangoon, Burma, Myanmar, into an extensive and prominent Sephardic Babylonian Jewish family. They had to abandon a comfortable life in Burma to Calcutta, India, escaping from the Japanese invasion of Burma in 1942. While working for the American Army Air Force Base there, She met her first husband, Robert Marys, of Taos, New Mexico. They married early 1945, with Sima then becoming the first war bride of the CBI Theater of Operations. Sima, alone and expecting, traveled under wartime conditions by sea, train, and bus from Calcutta to Taos. She lived with the primarily Spanish-speaking family of her husband on a frontier ranch near present-day Angel Fire, New Mexico. The adobe house was without electricity, telephone, and water sewer services. Mail was delivered by horseback once a week. Later, when husband Robert was discharged from the war, the family moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then to Denver, Colorado. Sima became a single mother in 1959 and raised her three children in Lakewood. She remarried in 1980 to Ray Betts, who preceded her in death. Sima worked at all times primarily as senior secretarial staff to a Martin Marietta Titan rocket engineering department, and then as a founding employee of the city of Lakewood. She retired in 1999 with a sizable estate and passed away peacefully at 95 on December 25th, 2021. May her memory be for a blessing. Sima Betts, Nee Saul Lakewood, mother of Ramona Cox, Ben Marys, and Joseph Dean, sister of Simon Saul, Charles Saul, of blessed memory, and Solly Saul, of blessed memory. Grandmother of Evelyn, Heather, Natalie, Michelle, and Sullivan, Morgan. Service Wednesday, 10 a.m., Feldman Mortuary Chapel, Interment Global Hill Cemetery. Live stream available on Feldman's Mortuary YouTube channel. Contributions may be made in Sima's name to a charity of your choice. Richard L. Herring, July 2, 1937 to December 19, 2021. Richard L. Herring, a man of a million smiles and stories, passed away peacefully at home in Lakewood, Colorado on December 19, 2021, at the age of 84 years old. Dick was a beloved and devoted father, grandfather, brother, lawyer, friend, mentor, and storyteller. He was born and raised in DeWitt, Iowa, where he proudly worked on the family farm. He graduated from DeWitt Central High School and then the University of Iowa, where he earned a degree in mathematics and later his Juris Doctorate, all on athletic scholarship. He became a member of the Iowa Bar Association and served 1 year as law clerk to Chief Judge Roy L. Stevenson of the United States District Court for Iowa. In 1963, he moved to Denver and became a member of the Colorado Bar Association and worked as an associate at Calkins, Kramer, Grimshaw, and Herring for 3 years before making partner. He was a brilliant lawyer and passionate about practicing law. He retired in 2012 but continued to provide legal services pro bono. Richard loved to play golf, attend Broncos and Rockies games with his family, playing cards, and work in the garden. He was devoted to lifelong learning and continued to participate in the great discussions whenever he could. He was a member of the Denver Athletic Club, Columbine Country Club, and Westwood's Men's Club, where he fostered his love of athletics for most of his life. Dick is survived by his adoring children, Joe, Jeff, Mike, wife Monica, and Lisa, husband Chris, his grandchildren, Deva, Michaela, Corbin, Kinsley, and Caleb, his sister, Erlene, nieces, Jana, Sherilyn, husband, Monty, and nephews, Lance, wife, Stacy, Brent, wife, Robin, and Bryce. Visitation will be 5 to 8 p.m. on January 5th, 2022 at Olinger Crown Hill Mortuary and Cemetery, 7777 West 29th Avenue in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. The funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. January 6, 2022 at Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran Church, 7691 South University Boulevard, Centennial, Colorado, 80122. Joyce Gleed Knight, Joyce Gleed Knight, age 93, passed away on December 20th, 2021 in Littleton, Colorado. She was a beloved wife, mother, sister, grandmother, and great-grandmother. Memorial services will be held Thursday, December 30th, 2021, 10:30 a.m. 11:30 viewing, 11:30 a.m. service at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints meeting house at 6705 South Webster Street, Littleton, Colorado. Please visit OllingerChapelHill.com for full obituary. John R. McLaughlin, March 22, 1933 to December 25, 2021. Son of John Charles and Margaret Hogan McLaughlin, survived by son Michael McLaughlin and daughters Molly Maxwell and Patricia McLaughlin, and by his best friend Nancy Baird. John was a 1956 U.S. Naval Academy graduate, naval officer, math teacher, soccer coach, and published author of Murder at Pullman High. Interment will be at Fort Logan alongside his previously deceased wife, Janet Hazelton. Mary D. Poole. A bright light went out in this world on November 29, 2021, when Mary Dury Poole died in Denver, Colorado. Mary had been hospitalized in late August with heart disease and was discharged to home hospice care in September. In her final months, she enjoyed visits from all her children and grandchildren, to whom she was deeply devoted, and she lived to celebrate her 90th birthday on November 14th. She died peacefully at home in the care of her children, just as she wished, with the same grace, good humor, and generosity of spirit that characterized her life. Mary was born in Delaware, Iowa, to the late William O. and Gertrude Dury, and spent most of her young life in Springfield, Minnesota. She attended Carleton College and graduated Phi Beta Kappa from the University of Minnesota with a bachelor's degree in English. She married Robert C. Bob Poole in Des Moines, Iowa, in December 1952. The couple moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1958, where Mary fully embraced a life dedicated to family community service and later significant professional endeavors. She engaged actively in the lives of four children, assuming leadership roles in PTA, Girl Scouts, and the YMCA, among others. Mary enjoyed cooking, sewing, quilting, and entertaining, and cultivated a warm, welcoming, well-organized home. She was the consummate community volunteer, tapped again and again for her leadership abilities. She was active in the Junior League, serving as president of the Junior League of Albuquerque and later as president of the Association of Junior Leagues International. She served on numerous boards, including the United Way and the Albuquerque Academy, and as president of the Albuquerque Community Foundation and the University of New Mexico Foundation. She was elegant and practical in the same breath. Never one to sit still, Mary grew and challenged herself through her life. As her children became more independent, she joined the paid workforce, simultaneously earning her master's degree in public administration. She was employed by Southwest Community Health Services as Vice President of Community Relations and Development and as the Executive Director of the Presbyterian Healthcare Foundation. She continued her volunteer work as well, serving nationally on the board and as president of the Association of Healthcare Philanthropy. After Bob's death in 1992, Mary worked as senior partner for research and studies for Gerald Panis Lindsay and Partners, a premier national consulting firm for philanthropy. Even after Mary moved to Denver in 2004 and began to slow down, she didn't. She continued to travel extensively and read voraciously, kept abreast and engaged in current affairs, frequented cultural attractions, wrote poetry, some of it published, and self-published a memoir. She was a remarkable, multi-talented woman with boundless energy and generous heart. Mary is survived by her four children, Lauren Poole, husband Charles Maston, Diana Poole, husband Steve Less, David Poole, wife Winona Poole, and Anna Marie Poole, husband Jonathan Rosenberg. Six grandchildren, Jana Ellis, wife Pedro Elias, Kendra Poole, Aaron Poole, Zachary Lass, Sarah Lass, May Lass, Gabriel Elias. Other survivors include two sisters, Nancy Glusker, husband David Glusker, and Kay Johnson, wife Terry Johnson, son-in-law Arden Poole, and brother-in-law Stan Murphy. Many nieces, nephews, and cousins, and her beloved companion for the past 7 years, Paul Goodspeed. She was preceded in death by her husband Bob and her old sister Patricia Murphy. In light of the ongoing pandemic and the predicted Omicron variant surge, a virtual memory service is being planned. For details and a link to the service, please email marymemorial2022@gmail.com. Memorial gifts may be made to the Legal Aid Foundation of Colorado, 1120 Lincoln Street, Suite 701, Denver, 80203. Frances H. Taylor. Frances Hazelhurst Taylor passed away peacefully on December 6, 2021. She was born June 7, 1931 in Colorado Springs to Edith Billings Farnsworth and George Blagden Hazelhurst. Frances enjoyed a lifelong love of reading, beginning at her mother's bookstore in Colorado Springs. She also developed a love of art through her grandfather, Francis Drexel Smith, an early Colorado artist. Frances attended Northampton School for Girls and Wellesley College, graduating in 1952. She married Eric Sprague Taylor in 1954. Frances worked as legal assistant for the Denver District Attorney and for the State of Colorado Attorney General's Office. She was active with the Crow Canyon Archaeological Center, Hotel de Paris Museum, National Trust for Historic Preservation, 4 Mile Historic Park, and the National Society of the Colonial Dames of America in Colorado. She enjoyed tennis, skiing, the family cabin in South Park, the great outdoors, traveling, and researching family history. Her passion for preservation led to the designation of her Denver family's home as a historic landmark. She was a member of the Denver Fortnightly Club and several beloved book clubs. Frances is survived by her three children, Eric S. Taylor Jr., Anne M. Taylor, Cheryl Ayers, and Jennifer T. Fox, husband William, and her four grandchildren, Madeline and Charlie Fox, Carrie and Brian Ayers, her brother John Hazelhurst, and several nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her husband, Eric Taylor. Services will be held Thursday, January 20th, 2022 at 11 a.m. at St. John's Episcopal Cathedral, 1350 North Washington Street, Denver. Memorials may be made to the Hotel de Paris Museum, the National Trust for Historic Preservation, or the Crow Canyon Archaeological Center. Robert L. Partenheimer. Please visit StorkFamilyMortuary.com for obituary and service information. Linda D. Tanner, May 13, 1941 to December 22, 2021. Linda D. Tanner, 80, passed away on December 22, 2021. For full obituary, please go to HoranCares.com. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. Mask or vaccinate? Denver extends mandate until February, by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. Denver's mask mandate, which was scheduled to expire on Monday, will be extended through February 3rd. New COVID-19 cases are rising rapidly, and about twice as many reported in Denver in the week ending Friday as were in the previous week. The percentage of tests coming back positive also has also jumped and indicated that significant numbers of cases are likely to be undetected. A similar pattern is happening statewide as the Omicron variant spreads. New COVID-19 hospital admissions have started to rise again after falling for roughly 4 weeks. Denver, Jefferson, Adams, and Arapahoe counties announced in late November that they were instating mask mandates in indoor public spaces, while Broomfield said it would only require masks in school, child care facilities, and county-run buildings. Boulder County has had a mandate since September. All opted to extend their mandates. With some differences, Broomfield's will expire January 31st, while Boulder and Jefferson counties pegged theirs to metrics like case counts rather than a date. Bob McDonald, executive director of the Denver Department of Public Health and Environment, said masks are a tool to limit the virus's transmission, but vaccines are the ultimate solution. We must continue to stay the course on science-based control measures like face coverings to ensure hospital beds are available for anyone in need, he said in a news release. The emergence of a new variant underscores the importance of not only getting the COVID-19 vaccine, but getting a booster dose as well. Businesses that don't want to require masks can opt to only admit vaccinated people. More than 500 offices, gyms, and other locations in Denver have attested that they have a plan to ensure 95% of staff and customers in their buildings at any time are fully vaccinated. The city's definition of fully vaccinated doesn't require booster shots. Denver's best new restaurant of 2021. For chef and owner Jose Avila, La Diabla is a very personal piece of Mexico City in the heart of the city, by Josie Sexton, the Denver Post. After a year of restaurant openings across Denver, Jose Avila's La Diabla stands out as one of the more personal and original eateries around. 90% of restaurants are just copycats of other restaurants with their own touch. But in Denver, there's nobody else to copy or lean on to open up this concept, said Avila, the chef and owner of La Diabla, Pozole y Mezcal. He opened La Diabla in June on one of Denver's most storied downtown streets and inside a century-old building that stands between a tattoo parlor and a pawn shop. The wood floors creak, the original bar has stories to tell, and the dining room always feels dark, even as sunlight beats on the back patio, about the size of a two-car parking spot. It's like old Mexico, Avila said, explaining how the restaurant is like an extension of himself. I always like to be in the background, but at the same time making noise. When Avila opened La Diabla, he did so quietly, without signage or fanfare. 6 months later, there is an empty corn sack hanging above the entrance that reads, Pozole Mezcal Tequila. It's about all you need to know before dining at La Diabla. The restaurant has subtly become a destination, and nobody knows, but everybody knows kind of thing, Avila said. As for the louder side to both the chef and La Diabla, there are the red and green walls that recall the Mexican flag, the bright pre-Hispanic symbols painted over top, but mostly it's all in the service and food. You can have cool decor, a great location, but if you don't have good food and service, you're just not going to survive, Avila said. So he draws deeply from the flavors of Mexico City, where he first started at taco carts and went on out for pozole with family once a week. I grew up with this, and basically every Tuesday I would go with my mom and brother to eat pozole at Pozolerias in Mexico, he said. I guess it was just a matter of time for me to put something together to open up this concept. By the time he moved to Denver 20 years ago, Avila was working his way up from dishwasher to cook and eventually head chef at local restaurants, many of them in Cherry Creek, Elway's Machete. But when he went out to eat himself, he noticed fellow Mexicans eating along Federal Boulevard, where he always assumed they were there for the broth. Now he wants Coloradans to become as fanatic about Mexican pozole as they are about other cultures, broths, such as Vietnamese pho. We kind of had to do our homework and change the idea that Mexican food doesn't go beyond tacos and tequila, Avila said. So on Thursdays, true to Mexican tradition, La Diabla serves 2-for-1 bowls of pozole for $17, which will likely leave you with leftovers for a party of two. Five varieties of nixtamalized, the hominy soaking process that reduces maize for tortillas, corn stews, all are $17, come with rich broths and chili salsas, heaping with pork or chicken, and topped with lettuce, cabbage, radish, and onions, plus limes for squeezing. On Wednesdays, La Diabla lures diners with probably the best happy hour in town. Two Al Pastor tacos, normally $3 each, and a house margarita for $5, until they sell out. You'll notice the pork grilling together with a pineapple or trompo, or spit, in front of the restaurant. And this, too, is straight from Mexico City, where taco shops spill onto sidewalks for carving meats in the open air. We knew coming in that we're going to have to work extra hard to draw people in, Avila said. Tacos have become an easy draw in Denver, but here they rise above, starting with a straightforward and perfect Al Pastor, and advancing to braised and stewed meats like beef birria with bone marrow. A lighter Huchanango red snapper is topped with citrus slaw and slathered in pineapple butter. And because La Diabla is on the same street as Snooze, we said, let's join the party, Avila said. Recently, he and his crew started serving a brunch of chilaquiles, $15, and huaraches, $12, plus breakfast burritos to go. La Diabla could easily fall into the traps of some of this now commonplace offerings. Tacos, margaritas, brunch. But it just doesn't give Avila, along with general manager Christine Farmer and bar manager Ivan Ramirez, is slowly bringing pozoleria and mezcaleria into the local vernacular, even if plenty of Coloradans don't know the words yet. We're downtown, and Mexican people aren't necessarily downtown, Avila said. So for us to see the place filled, sometimes with 60% Mexicans enjoying our food, that's when you know you're making something good. Mi panoy la piel chinita, he said, looking for the words in English. Metro Denver, home still rising 20% plus a year. Appreciation rocket may have reached its apex, according to Case Shiller Index, by Aldo Svaldi of the Denver Post. Metro Denver racked up its fourth consecutive month of 20% plus year-over-year home price gains in October, but the appreciation rocket may have reached its apex and could be preparing to come back to earth, according to the latest home price indices from S&P, CoreLogic, Case-Shiller, a closely followed measure of home price appreciation. Metro Denver home prices were up 20.3% in October compared to the same month a year earlier, according to Case-Shiller. That follows annual gains of 21.2% in September, 21.5% in August, and 21.3% in July. That run-up is unrivaled for intensity, but October's monthly change from September decelerated sharply to 0.2%, half of September's monthly pace, a quarter of August's pace, and a little more than a tenth of the monthly pace seen in July. It represents the slowest monthly increase measured in Metro Denver since December 2019. As the momentum wanes, gravity may be ready to take over unless another booster can be found in 2022. After reaching an all-time high in August, annual house price growth in the United States has deaccelerated in each of the last 2 months. But appreciation remains well above any rate ever measured prior to this year, said Zillow senior economist Kwame Donaldson in comments on the monthly report. To put this year's rates of appreciation in Denver in perspective, annual home price gains entered the double-digit territory in January and by April were accelerating faster than the prior record annual rate of 15% set back in February 2001. By July, they were at full thrust, roaring above 20%. Donaldson said the fuels of historically low interest rates, supply restrictions, which included a foreclosure moratorium, and increased savings that could be applied toward a down payment are starting to fade. But a robust labor market and rising wages, huge pent-up demand from millennials now at the peak buying age, and an unexpected tightening in the supply of homes available for sale could sustain momentum. House price appreciation will continue to slow from the summer's unsustainable levels, but these conditions ensure that growth will comfortably exceed normal rates over the next year, he predicted. Denver's 20.3% annual rate of home appreciation is above the U.S. rate of 19.1% in October, but it lags behind many other metros. Phoenix was the leader in October with a 32.3% year-over-year price increase, followed by Tampa at 28.1% and Miami at 25.7%. The slowing of home prices is most notably in colder and more expensive areas, as well as middle-tier priced homes where home buyers have less wiggle room in their budgets. Low-tier priced homes are still in higher demand as entry-level buyers and investors continue to compete for the very limited supply, said Selma Hepp, deputy chief economist at CoreLogic, in comments on Tuesday's report. It is also important to remember that metro area has had a much longer trajectory for strong home price gains. Metro Denver home prices are now 105% above the 2006 housing boom peak, compared to a 48% gain from the prior high nationally. From the prior high nationally, Hep notes in a blog repost on a blog post. This is the strongest showing of any major metro, although Dallas is close to 102% gain. Chicago, by contrast, is barely above its 2006 highs, while Las Vegas is only 11% higher. Appreciation leaders Phoenix and Tampa are only 30% above their old high price points, catching up only after the pandemic got underway. Apple shares slip as $3 trillion value proves elusive again, by Ryan Vlastelica, Bloomberg News. Apple shares closed lower on Tuesday with the iPhone maker slipping after a four-day rally that put it within striking distance of a historic $3 trillion market value, a threshold that has proved elusive for weeks. The stock fell 0.6% as investors rotated out of big tech names, closing at $179.29. Based on Apple's outstanding shares, it will reach $3 trillion if its stock hits $182.86. It rose as high as $182.13 in intraday trading this month. Should Apple reach the milestone, it will be the first time any company has done so. The achievement would cap a strong year for Apple, which has surged 35% in 2021 and ended Tuesday's session with a $2.94 trillion value. It is also up more than 200% since COVID first sent the world into lockdown early last year and underlined the centrality of technology for work, education, entertainment, and keeping connected. The stock has been a favorite because of the global popularity of the company's products, the potential for new offerings to maintain its steady sales growth, and its strong cash balance. Such tailwinds have helped investors look past potential risks like a shortage of chips and the ongoing pandemic, which prompted Apple to shut its New York City retail stores. Wall Street's other major tech and internet companies are also among the year's most notable outperformers. Apple shares recently came under pressure after the Federal Reserve took a more hawkish stance than it had expected, but investors bid them back up as they looked for high-quality equities. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post, December 29th edition. My name is Bill Head.